Welcome to the Poetic Resurrection Podcast, where we explore perceptions. How self-reflecting questions can give you a better understanding of self. I'm your host, Sonia Iris Lozada. Stay tuned. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Poetic Resurrection. And I am happy to have Jack Remick, a novelist, a poet, an instructor. I mean, he just does it all. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Sonia. I really do appreciate all the effort that you put into this, especially getting writers out there. We tend to be hermits, you know, and think that the work is the important thing. And you remember a long time ago, they used to say, 75% of your time writing, 25% promoting. And now we've flipped that. 25% yes. Writing, 75% promoting, because without that promotion, you're dead in the water, you know. So I really appreciate what you are doing, especially for poetry. It's just wonderful that you have the time and the energy to handle that. So thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. It's something that I feel very passionate about. I feel that people's voices need to be heard. Mm-hmm. Famous or not, we were going to discuss one of your poems.
Okay. Is there anyone that you have in mind, or can I just choose something for you?
You choose.
Satori is my big poetry book. Well, it's a small book, actually. But it contains poems that I have written on and at for several years. Mm-hmm. And in the course of my wandering through the world, I lived in South America for a while, and I met at that time a young poet named Jorge Bravo Munoz, who happened to be an acolyte of Pablo Neruda. And I'm not making any claims to fame here. I'm just saying how I got to where I got this. And through Bravo Munoz, I came across the 20 Poemas de Amor y una Canción Desdichada, which is one of Neruda's great love poem sequences. Yeah. And that form just stuck with me for all those years after I left South America. And so I, of course, found someone that I love dearly, and I wanted to write, but I didn't want to imitate, because one of the things that I learned early on from a poet named Tom Gunn is create your own universe. Don't live in another man's. So I decided I would keep the idea of a series of love poems followed by one poem that's sort of the unhappy poem, the desdichada part of it. And so if you have an ear for this, I'd like to read a couple sonnets from the sequence called The Body, 12 sonnets with a lament and love death. And one of my favorite ones is called The Dying of Dreams. When we were fire in flesh, what was snow? Your silk-clad breasts erupted triumphant against lace and fueled my ignorance of eternity. In truth, only certain parts of you existed. I kissed your lips and dreamed of breasts. I kissed your breasts but measured skin under trembling hands and mouths and time, no time. Like seasons, we have turned from flame to ember. Your waspish waist has grown its autumnal thorax. My manly pecs are winter-wrecked and softened sag. Now it is your mind that fascinates me. Despite the cult of youth, we know this. Flowers fade. We come to the closing of doors where we lie down naked for the dying of dreams.
That is so beautifully written. And I'm visualizing it as you're saying it. It's like, okay, the kiss, the breath, the time passing.
Yes. Yeah. This is what I learned by reading the 20 Poemas de Amor. And then the one that I really like is, well, I like all of these because they were written, you know, with that same kind of heartfelt sincerity. Rather than being about me, they're more about the other person who's involved, you know, which makes me think of, well, Shakespeare sonnets. So this is a one that I particularly like. And it's one that men are a little bit reluctant to touch on.
No.
It's called Secret Disease. Every woman knows she is a delicate flower suffering from a secret disease that each month erupts constant reminder, blood clock slave to genes. When you burst the blood blossom and strew the crimson petals on moon's altar, you sacrifice one-fourth of your living to the red goddess within you. Heavy is the price of passion, time, the sword that leaves no wound, blood from the wound that leaves no scar. I am spectator to this celestial event. I hold you, smell your changing scent, touch you, count the hours in your skin.
Wow. I mean, you're touching on a sensitive subject, but yet it's so beautifully done that you're like, oh.
That's what I think. Men are so scared to death of women because of that power. We talk about it all the time. But women do have the power. The power, it's there, and we can't deny it. And so I think that we kind of have to honor that. And that's what I was doing here. And then the last one that I really like is this notion of when love abandons you, sometimes, you know, you don't know how to feel. And So this is called Love Death. I am an exile from your touch, as though I were dead. Were I dead, this agony finds its explanation. While you remain, your eyes grace other windows than my eyes, where there are no flowers of spring. No sweetness rains off your fingers on flesh become a desert. This winter chill kills with a cold so deep cold I die white-blooded. What used to bind us blinds us, the habit of having days run by without love running from your mouth that once overran with passion. This made us accept love death. It is now late, too late, and love's bones lie scattered. That's one of my favorites in the collection, Satori.
That's a beautiful collection.
It is.
It's, you know, I love it. I wish I was that good at my. I always get these mixed up, similes and metaphors.
Yeah.
Where you just work them in and you don't have to use like or as.
Exactly.
They just are there and they're interwoven and they're so beautifully done.
Yes. Well, one of the.
When did that book come out?
I think it was 20, I'd have to see, Sonia, I think it's 2014. So it's been out a while. Let me ask you a question. Do you ever read your reviews?
Sometimes, because I don't know. It's my way, even if it's a negative review, I want to know how it's being perceived.
Yeah.
And like my first book was very easy to understand. So I got a lot of reviews on that because the average person that didn't even like poetry wrote a review. The second book was a little bit more complicated. And I don't think people understood the reflection of what I was talking about.
Right.
And I think that that's something that I learned from. Mm-hmm. You know, I had someone say, I really loved your first one. The second one was a little confusing to me. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of poets do this.
Yes.
We get in our own head and we can see the vision, but unless we can put it on paper where someone can understand, they don't see it.
Yeah.
And I think that's why. And my goal for poetry has always been, I want everybody to love poetry. So let me make it simple.
Yeah.
I don't have an ego to make it so complicated, because I've read people that everybody says, oh, this is a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. And I read their stuff because I want to learn.
Yeah.
And I don't get it.
I've been there too on that. That's a hard thing to adjust to. Let me tell you a little bit about how I got into poetry. You know, wild young man running around doing things. And I wind up at Berkeley and I take a class in poetry from an English poet named Tom Gunn, who was a friend of Sylvia Plath and her husband, whose name I just have forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing poems at that time, and I've sort of said this a few times before, but I was imitating everybody that I'd ever read. You know, I'd imitate Shakespeare and Wordsworth and Coleridge, and I could quote Byron. You know, I was doing all that. And I wrote a poem called Ode to Kepler, and I submitted it to the class. And Tom Gunn took me aside, and he said, Jack, when you inhabit another man's universe, it's always smaller than the one you'll create for yourself. Now, this Kepler poem, he says, is opening a door for you. So why don't you go that way? And so I took that to heart. And mm-hmm. I realized that I had so much to learn, but I had to listen to other people instead of just doing my own thing. And I'd been listening to the voices of Wordsworth, and Coleridge. I could quote, weave a circle round him, weave it thrice, and close your eyes in holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise. That's Coleridge, Kubla Khan, mm-hmm. And then when Byron comes around with the Hebrew melodies, the Assyrian came down like the wolf on the fold, and his cohort was gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly o'er deep Galilee. And of course, you get caught up in that and you want to imitate it. But Tom Gunn pulled the reins and said, go your own direction. And that was so important for me. And I learned so much about writing just by listening to that inner voice. I'd write a line and I'd say, does this sound like Wordsworth? Does this sound like Cole? Is this, and am I just reading Gerard Manley Hopkins again, writing it? And I think, well, even with the Neruda poems, I didn't want to imitate Neruda except for the idea of putting a selection of poems together that sort of cohered around this common thread and then developing them to the height of my skill at that time. Anyway, that's how I came to be a poet.
Beautiful. And you also teach poetry.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. Yes,
there's so many opinions out there. Like some people go, subjective. How could you really teach it? But you could really teach it. And the biggest criticism I've heard is when you're editor for poetry. Yes. It's like, if you're not going through it, how do you know? But it could be done as like correcting grammar. And you could tell someone like, I have an editor, and they come back and says, this is not clear.
Oh, boy, that word clear. That word clear is one. Now, I sort of following on what you said, how can you teach poetry? And so my idea for teaching poetry is kind of the same as my idea for teaching prose or fiction. I don't think you can teach another writer to write. What I think you can do is keep them writing until they pick up the techniques and learn how to write for themselves. So there are techniques that I've developed for giving writers, a direction, like you use the word clarity. If it's not clear, you have to clear away the stuff that gets in the way of the images. You can teach that. And that's where you do sort of line work. You say, well, there are too many words in this line. And, what happens if you change this and change that? And I avoid the word you should. I rarely, if ever, use the word should when I'm talking to another writer about writing. I say, what happens if you do this? Well, let's try this. Let's massage it and see what happens when we put different words in there. You mentioned simile and metaphor. I question sometimes as I get older, and this is something I think every poet has to confront. I question the notion of a simile, like this is like that, I kind of prefer to say, well, what's her name? A rose by any other name is still a rose, Gertrude Stein. Mm-hmm. The metaphor is sometimes more effective than you can teach that. See, we'll do a metaphor. Mm-hmm. So that's how kind of I approach it. And teaching poetry is very, very hard. And another thing that I try to avoid is being cruel. I won't use the word hurt, but I've been maligned by a lot of writers. You say, oh, you don't want to do that. And so I try to make it a habit, never hurt another writer, because we're all delicate beasts. We're delicate little flowers, and we need to be guided, not, torn up by the roots and thrown aside. So that's kind of my approach to teaching.
Yeah, that happened to me, actually. I wanted to be a writer, and a professor told one of my friends, oh, she should never be a writer. She just doesn't have it. And he told me, and it did stop me for a couple years to write. And that's like the worst thing you could ever tell somebody, because if it's grammar, you can fix that.
Exactly.
But you cannot create creativity. Right. That they have to find on their own. And I feel that a writer becomes more creative when you allow yourself to be vulnerable.
I think so. You know, there's a saying in music. I worked for a long time with at that time, he was an elderly composer, pianist named John Verrill. And he would give me lectures about all the things that he had read that he knew about other musicians and composers. He says, Jack, you know, the one thing in music that cannot be taught is melody. And you just touched on that. You know, how do you teach creativity? You know, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. And he would also say the only meaning in music is emotion. I say, what? You know, what about this other? But he had these ideas that creativity is something that springs from this, I hate to use the metaphor, this deep inner well of understanding that you come to as you age. And I think that's why there's so few really accomplished young writers, is they haven't taken the time to explore the past and to come face to face with the point where it ceases being sort of the learned product of learning and becomes more about that precise moment where the mind opens up and something really creative pops out. To me, that's, you know, Yes. That's that moment when you feel, I hate to say, you feel almost divine. Can I say that?
It's like you feel so in
the
zone. Yes,
exactly.
Like if you were an athlete, it's like, it just opens up and you're like, oh, I can't write fast enough to catch up with my
exactly.
thoughts.
Yes, yes. That's that moment. That's that moment of divinity. You know, when you find yourself in the old days, you say, well, the gods are speaking to me, of course, you know, and that's a metaphor for that stuff. But boy, that's a really a powerful feeling, you know, when you get it. And it can't be taught. You have to wait for the spark to come from within.
Yes.
I would like to be able to teach it, but you can't. There's just no way to do it. Same way you can't teach melody. And I believe John Verrill talking about Schubert when he said, in music, everything can be taught except melody. And Schubert, as he was later, after he had accomplished, had written his 9 symphonies and all of his Lieder and everything, he decided it was time to go study counterpoint. Can you imagine an accomplished at that stage? Can you imagine, you know, well, name some poet going off to study rhyme, for example. Just beautiful ideas. So you and I are pretty much agreed on that moment of clarity when it becomes clear and you see and, oh, you.
And I noticed that the more you work on something, the harder it becomes.
Yeah.
So I have been stuck where I've done the whole poem. And the last line or the closing last phrases, it just doesn't come to me.
Yes.
And so I said, okay, let it go. Go meditate.
Yes.
Go
Perfect.
For a walk. Do something. You need to quiet the ever-persistent mind. It doesn't want to shut up. It's just like, are you sure? This is hard. You know, you don't want to be deterred. Go out in nature if you can, if the weather's good, or meditate. And that's what I have to do. And I have to let it go, maybe work on another poem or another story, because you got to be clear before you.
Well, write. You really nailed it right there, to be patient. I tell students, well, I do this weekly, what I call interactive rewriting masterclass. And I tell writers, well, let's work it today, this week, and bring it back next week. You know, don't send it out. Bring it back and we'll work it again, because in a week you might have discovered something really deeper that you need to get out. I can teach patience. I can be patient. Look at that last line, as you said, and leave it alone, because it'll speak to you some point down the line. But you got to wait. And it's so painful because, gosh, we want to get out and get recognition and get it in print. And, you know, and really what you want is that poem to sing. Really to sing. And that's what I love about, well, that's what I really love about, you know, well, Jack Moody, one of my mentors, I may have mentioned him in that bio, I don't remember, but I asked him one time, I said, Jack, have you ever written an epic poem? And he thought for a second, he said, 6 lines or 8? 6. Wait a minute.
Isn't epic a lot more?
Wait a minute. But what he was telling me is how deep and hard the good poem is. And so he comes up with a poem. It's called The Edge of Death. Up to the quiet edge of death, along five highways of converging air, the senses come like evening cattle home, and they meet there. You know, this is a poem about, is it a poem about cows? No. Is it a poem about, well, what is it about? Well, it's about death, of course, and the senses are, you know, it's just a very complex poem, and the poem just has such texture to it that I just love the man's lines. He died a few years ago, kind of a tragic death, you know, but anyway, it doesn't matter. But he was insistent upon the density and the texture and the complexity of the poem. Doesn't matter how long it is, it's how deep and pure and crystalline and clear it is. And I really learned a good lesson from him about.
Every time I think of an epic poem, I think of the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah.
That's a very long poem. It's like a book.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you working on now?
I am working on my next poetry book. I'm also writing sci-fi, but short stories. And they're very cerebral, but they're more like it's not fantasy because I'm not creating a world. Mm-hmm. It's sci-fi. I read about it. And the best thing for me, I go, how do you tell the difference? And it says in fantasy, you create the world. In sci-fi, it's probable.
Okay, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, because look at Jules Verne.
Yeah.
Everything he thought of that was sci-fi was probable.
Exactly. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I hadn't thought of it that way. I wrote a novel called Doubles in a Game of Chance that I couldn't classify as sci-fi, science fiction. What is it? You know, it's unclassifiable. But what you say there makes perfect sense when I put it in the context. What is in a world where this might happen, this could also happen. So it's probable. And I think that's a good approach. I'm not particularly fond of the fantasy world myself, but that probable part of it, you know, if you can project it into the future, like Dune, they just remade Dune into a series, I guess. And of course, number two
is coming out.
And Frank Herbert, of course, was a seer. I mean, he was projecting, well, if this happens, then this can happen. And we could, you know, this is what it would look like. So in effect, that is true sci-fi in that it's probable, right? Am I right on that track?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I had my editor look at it and he said, this kind of reminds me of this writer. It's not real sci-fi. There's no wars. There's nothing like that. It's all cerebral. Okay. It's all, I would call it psychological sci-fi. It's probable, but it's more deals with our perceptions.
Well, isn't that what Blade Runner is all about, is the probability of if you are going to create androids and then the human imitating human beings, then this is what might happen. And I think that's a very cerebral movie. The book is totally different, but there's a line in there where the guy who has what he calls Methuselah syndrome, where he starts to get aged too fast, and he talks to the android and he says, there's some of you in me, or some of me in you. And what he means mm-hmm. is the android has only 5 years to live. So, you know, it's a very cerebral thing.
That was their whole fight. They wanted to live longer
than
5 years. And it was, at first you're like, oh, they're just killers. And then, but you have compassion for them because that's all they wanted to do. They just wanted to live more than 5 years. I mean, that's the bottom line on it. They wanted to know what it was like to be human.
There's that great scene where the android goes to meet Terrell, the creator of all this. And he says, yes, my son, what can I do for you? And he says, I want more life.
You have a great memory. I don't remember any lines from that, but then he kills him.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't he?
Sort of the irony of it all, the son killing the father, isn't it? Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah.
That's very Shakespearean.
Yes, it is. Lovely. You know, so let me ask you a question about when you write, you have a story in mind, or does the story come to you as you write?
Most of my writing, and this might sound woo-woo, comes from dreams or meditation, and it's very fragmented. Mm-hmm. I wrote a poetry book called Follow Akashic Dreaming Through Time because I found out that, you know, it's going back and forth and there really is no set time. And it was like, there was one that came up and I saw a guy doing pottery The emotion was sadness. And then I saw the number 300 BC. Wow. That was it. That's all I got. And I ended up looking, and it was 300 BC. So I started looking in Europe. I looked South America, and I looked everywhere. And then I saw the terracotta soldiers. Yeah. So I did all this research on Qin Shi Huang, who was the emperor, what he ordered, how these people lived. And so it was so hot there that they would use the incarcerated to work the fields. And so I, you know, I put all that together. It's a lot of research for one paragraph.
Well, that raises a big question for me. How much of the work, or the, I'll put it this way, how much of the content of your work then comes from research, and how much comes from, and I'm going to use imagination. You know, do you see a difference between the research and the imagination? Could you have invented this Chinese character through time just out of your imagination, or do you have to find a basis in reality for it?
Well, I was wondering why it gave me 300 BC. And I said, there's something here. And what I had to do was keep the sadness that the character was feeling, use the lighting, because the lighting was beautiful. It's, I had all these beautiful colors in it. So a lot, that was imagination. But in order for someone to understand it, I felt like, you know, I was being given a sign of some kind. Let me research this. And I had these, for a period of time, I kept having the same kind of dreams. Different stories, but fragmented looks at it. That's why I called it Akasha Dreaming Through Time. I kind of wonder, when am I looking at past lives? What's going on here? But I would say, on generally, when I'm writing, it's more creative, and I have to put it into writing. And that's why it was so hard for me to start in the beginning, because I had all these visions and stories, and it was so hard for me to put on paper.
One of the things my wife tells me, she says, if you're going to write historical stuff, you've got to find a way to link it to the current time. Some way you have to find. Otherwise, it's just a costume drama. And story set in 300 BC might be interesting, but how do you link it to the present time? How do you make...
Oh, because of sadness.
Okay, there you go. See the cycle.
The sadness, it was being in a job that he had.
You just described 90% of the workers in America.
Exactly. And that's what it was about. It was about, he was an artisan. He worked really hard to for his family and everything, but he hated his job. Dear. It was hot. He would sweat. He was by the kilns. It, you know, so it just talks about that.
So it's not just a costume drama. It's talking about a human being in a certain situation, not happy, looking, and just so sad. That's really good. That's the psychology that I think my wife keeps telling me I have to dig into. That's very good. Love it.
I'll send you a PDF.
Yeah, that'd be good. That'd be good. I'd like to see that.
Yeah. So we are getting towards the end of our interview. Is there something that you would like to address to the audience?
Wow. Well, we've touched on a lot of things here: creativity, ingenuity, history, research, the emotional deep part of writing, the patience of writing. You've covered just a whole world of notes that I think every writer should attend to. The only thing that we haven't touched on overtly is exactly what we're doing now, which is the notion of networking, of trying to find other people who connect you to another world of art from whom you might find some guidance. You might even find a mentor, someone who can look at your work. So I would leave this message out there. Don't live your life alone as an artist. Take the time to find other people who share your vision of art, because deep down, and this is as heartfelt as I can get, I think that art is salvation. And I think that without poetry, and I'm going to be really cynical here, without poetry and this creative light that guides us sometimes, we're just a tribe of very efficient killers. And I don't want to be a member of that tribe. I want to be a member of the tribe that brings light and I hate to be silly here, but goodness, you know, and you can write deep, hard, rough stuff and still be bringing some light into the world. And so I think that the more you associate with other writers, and here's a big factor, Sonia, work with people who know more than you do, because you can never learn if you just, it just becomes subjective and, oh, I like this, I don't like that. But the person who sees just the next step closer to the abyss will say, why don't you take a risk here? Take the time to step one foot over the edge of the cliff and see what happens, you know, see what happens. You won't fall, you know, you'll keep going, but you got to take that risk. And by taking risk, I mean, take chances with style, with content, fuse genres if you have to, do disruptive things, be disruptive, you know, you don't have to be rebellious, but just be disruptive. And I think all of that is what I would tell young writers or old writers, you know, work with someone who knows more than you do, listen to them, to what they say, take the chance and be patient. Be patient. Let your art develop, because art will save you. Poetry is salvation. Every time I say something like that, I go back to Garcia Lorca, you know, verde, verde, que te quiero, verde, verde, ramas, you know, that poem, Green. He just rolls it out there. You don't care what it says. It just feels good, you know, and that's art. I think that's art, you know, so. That's about all I can say to what you've said. I think I really appreciate this, Sonia. Very important. We're networking, exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes. Yeah. And you have been amazing. And I am so grateful that I got the chance to meet you, and we talked and doing all of this. And all the stuff he refers to people will be in the notes.
Okay, well, thank you, and, you know, much happiness. Namaste.
Many blessings. Thank you for listening to the Poetic Resurrection podcast, available on Apple iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Music, and many other podcast platforms. Please visit us and subscribe to our newsletter at poeticresurrection.com for the latest information and updates.